And Guy?
Okay. I want to welcome everybody to the April 2023 meeting of the NCA. And I have a few announcements and also some past events to just mention. On March 25th, the DC chapter of the International Dark Sky Association attempted to get local institutions to turn out their lights from 8:30 to 9:30. And unfortunately, we were either completely ignored or they said, oh, that's a great idea, but somebody else can do that. We'll have a postmortem on that. I don't know if any of you participated, but the idea to...
We did.
Good for you. Good for you. I turned out the lights at my granddaughter's place in North Carolina, and we looked at the moon through a telescope that they had made. We talked about light pollution. But in any case, at the Eisenhower Memorial on Independence Avenue, very close to the Air and Space Museum, there was a telescope viewing on April 2nd. I was, you know, still not feeling well at all and did not go. Elizabeth, you said you were there. Do you want to say a few words about it?
Yeah, sure. If you want to stop your share and I'll share my
sure. Pictures. Great.
So we got we were invited by the Trust for the National Mall to come out and do sort of a telescope viewing. It was Eisenhower Under the Stars, and basically to commemorate Eisenhower signing NASA into existence. And so they're trying to start doing this little thing in front of over by the Eisenhower Memorial. So a couple of organizations participated. Novak had a small group of folks there with a unistellar scope. Jeff Gerber was there. UMD was there with a couple of scopes and with primarily with grad students and an undergrad sort of leading the way. And we had grad students from the astronomy department and geology. And so we're not really saying it's the astronomy department doing that. We're calling it the space science outreach cooperative for right now. So we had a pretty good crowd of people through the 2 hours, 7:30 to about 9:30, with a number of telescopes. And somewhere in here, there is a picture with Jeff. So here's the Novak group with their unistellar scope. They had it set up. This was early in the evening, so they had it pointing at the moon. They had a little computer here to show what it was showing. Jeff was there as well. And so he's somewhere in here. I know I've got a picture. We had the geology grad student had like a table with some meteorites and meteorongs set up, and we had some other handouts and materials there. So kind of talking to that. There's Jeff. So he had a telescope set up as well. At this point, he was looking at Betelgeuse or something, not too sure, but he was looking at, so he had his scope set up as well. But through the evening, so this is starting to thin out a little bit, but through the evening it got pretty crowded at various times, so we're estimating about 1,000 people came through there. Obviously not the best location. We actually had a couple of lights. They have these sort of down pointing lights, which kind of made it convenient for like the table setup, but we kind of, with the telescopes, kind of had to maneuver in between some of the spots, and we were really limited to just the moon, Venus, the Orion Nebula, you know, really, really bright stuff. But it was a good evening. We had a really good pass of the International Space Station, so that was a big hit with a lot of everyone, to have everyone all looking in the same direction and such. There's Jeff again. But yeah, it was the, this is the second year I think they've had it, so they'll more than likely have it again next year. So it's the Trust for the National Mall, and under the stars at Eisenhower Memorial, although everyone pretty much called it just Eisenhower under the stars. So,
well, yep. Thank you. Okay, got a few other, let's see. So I have got to share my screen again now. Yeah. So, okay, so that was that. And then coming up, we have a number of things. Let's see. One of our other local clubs, the Northern Virginia Astronomy Club, they're meeting tomorrow night. Exploring the Sky is April 15, Rock Creek Park, starting at the Planetarium Nature Center. This is new. If you haven't heard that, they're going to put on a planetarium show at 8 o'clock. The observing starts at 9 o'clock. The two locations are maybe 200 yards apart. And also April 15th is Astronomy for Everyone out in Northern Virginia, Sky Meadow State Park. That starts at 8. And April 22nd is an open house free at Hopewell Observatory. You can see details on that in the current Stardust. And also April 22nd, NOVAC is having their Astronomy Day at Crockett State Park in Virginia. And April 29th, there's public observing at the Udvar Hazy Museum out near Dulles. NCA still needs people to come with telescopes at Exploring the Sky. It's not as bad a location as the Eisenhower Memorial, but it's still inside DC and inside the Beltway, obviously. For the NCA solar scope, it would be really nice to have people to staff it. One thing I've noticed when looking through it is you're very much dependent on the local seeing, and the local seeing can change in a matter of seconds to being crystal clear, and you're seeing all this structure on the sun, and then a few moments later, it's just a blur. It's really, really strange. I think it would be really nice to be able to give our speakers something like an NCA hat or a t-shirt or something like that, and plus, you know, for us to wear at events. So if we've got any graphic designers, that'd be really nice. And as you all probably know, we've got exactly 1 year from today, although not at this time of day, going to be a total solar eclipse that goes from Mazatlan, Mexico, through San Antonio and Austin, Texas, and then up through the parts of the Great Lakes and the Maritime Provinces. And people are probably making plans for what to do. I went and looked up some hotels in Austin, and I could not believe they're charging like $800 a night. I could not believe it, but maybe I should. All right. So, all right. That's all I have. Does anybody else have any announcements you would like to make? Well, not hearing any announcements.
Hi, everyone. I'm one of Professor Williams' students. I was invited by him to this group. And I think it's going to be very interesting. My name is Emmanuel. Hi.
He's okay. A good student.
Good.
Okay. Well, it's a really great pleasure to welcome again our speaker tonight, Professor Joe Pesch, who in February 2022 gave us a wonderful talk on black holes, and who tonight will tell us about one of the newest and most important tools of ground-based astronomy. He has a bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Colorado in Boulder, master's of science and master of philosophy, and PhD in astrophysics from Cambridge University and from the International School for Advanced Studies in Trieste, Italy. He's at the National Science Foundation and also at George Mason University. Every galaxy having a central bulge, such as our own galaxy and such as our future interaction partner, the Andromeda Galaxy, also has a supermassive black hole at its center. And a supermassive black hole is a black hole whose mass is millions or more times that of our sun. The gravitational attraction of so much mass attracts nearby material which orbits the black hole, and occasionally some of that material falls into the black hole, making it still more massive. That is, sometimes the black hole eats something. But usually not all, it doesn't usually eat all of the involving object. The uneaten material in its nearby magnetized plasma forms a pair of enormously long jets of ultra-relativistic electrically charged particles guided by a magnetic field that was twisted by the black hole's rotation. And this combination of relativistic charged particles and a twisted magnetic field emits intense radiation in many parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So the black hole is not invisible. We can detect that radiation and learn something from it about the black hole and its environment. The radiation we receive is especially intense when one of the two jets points directly towards us. And then we also see features of the jet that we do not see when we look at a jet from the side. Joe's research is focused on these jets that are aimed directly at us and on their host galaxies, and on the influence of the clusters of galaxies that contain those host galaxies. He's also done research on the effect of clusters of galaxies on the rate at which stars form in the galaxies in the cluster. After holding research positions at the Space Telescope Science Institute and at Penn State University, he became a program officer at the U.S. National Science Foundation, where he's responsible for most of the U.S. government's ground-based radio astronomy facilities. The newest ground-based radio astronomy facility is called by the acronym ALMA, A-L-M-A. It's on a high, dry plateau in Chile because water vapor is a major impediment to radio astronomy. ALMA is one of our game-changing new observatories with a status like the James Webb, like that of the James Webb Space Telescope. And this evening, Joe will tell us about this remarkable new tool for astronomy. But before turning the meeting over to him, I have a question based on one of Todd Seppel's wonderful descriptions of new discoveries in astronomy in Stardust. His article in the sidebar in the Stardust mentions that radio emission has been detected from the filaments of material in the cosmic web that joins clusters of galaxies in our universe. And one of my questions will be, has ALMA played a role in that detection? Joe, it's all yours.
Thank you, John. That was a wonderful introduction. And I very much appreciate being here again. And so apparently you enjoyed my first talk well enough to invite me back. So that's always a very nice thing. And so that was wonderful. Let me start sharing my screen here. And we're going to go into display mode. Everyone can, oh, hang on. Let me back out again. I forgot to do one thing. It's not really important, but I need to turn on sound. There we go. Okay, so that's good. Okay. Isn't technology wonderful? Okay, so everyone can see the presentation.
Yes.
Good. So as John, in that wonderful introduction, pointed out, I'm going to be talking about one of my favorite, currently favorite instruments. I've worked with lots of them, and I have lots of favorites. But I'm a little bit biased because I'm responsible for ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. And so it will play a large part of the talk tonight because, you know, our instruments are given short shrift usually in astronomy talks. But I do want to spend some words on some of the very important discoveries that it's making. I have a slide about myself. I don't need to go into that because, number one, I've been here before, but also because John gave that wonderful fulsome background. I did want to point out, I think as I did before, that the backdrop image here is one of my objects, one of my favorite objects, Markarian 421. And it is the object on the left. It's an active galactic nuclei, so it has a supermassive black hole in the middle, and we are basically looking at the jet face on. And you see that the current model of what's going on here on the bottom right. So long ago, when I started working with these objects called Bielak objects after their prototype, Biel Lacerda, I looked at the field and I thought, well, there hasn't been much work done on Bielak objects, so I think I will do that. And very quickly, I realized why a lot of work had not been done, because they are just so difficult to observe. You know, you have that bright, it's like a bright flashlight pointing right at your face. It's like the floodlights at the Air and Space Museum when you're trying to observe with a telescope, right? And in this Hubble Space Telescope image we hear in false color, of course, we have the bright central region, which is the emission coming from near the supermassive black hole along the jet. And then the fuzz around it is the surrounding giant elliptical galaxies. So some, you know, 1 trillion stars or so. And when we say that the central point source in the AGN is brighter, it outshines the entire galaxy. Well, this is a good example of that. And you might say, well, but, you know, we can see the galaxy, so what's the problem here? Well, we can see the galaxy only because of the fabulous resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. The difference between the central point source and the fuzz, the haze of the stars that surround it, is about 10 million to one, possibly 100 million to one. So, you know, it's just a tremendously bright source of light. And really, again, until Hubble came along, we really weren't able to understand these guys. And they're still enigmatic, but they're really important because we are able to peer down through that jet in a way that allows us to get very near the supermassive black hole. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about black holes later on, but we'll leave black holes for now. So before I go on, well, first of all, I believe several people have been down to ALMA. Is that correct? Maybe on the call tonight? I don't see everyone, but I think some members of NCA had been down to ALMA. You may go visit ALMA. You're not able to go to the high site. There's two parts of ALMA, and I'll discuss that shortly. Before I get into discussing ALMA, I want to give a quick primer on radio astronomy. And you are all savvy astronomers in the radio realm as well. But let me cover this very quickly, because, you know, radio is sadly part of the electromagnetic spectrum that isn't well known, and there's obvious reasons, right? We don't see radio waves. So here on the left, I have one of the 25 meter antennas of the Very Large Array, you know, canonical radio telescope, and the photons come from space above, and they hit the dish just like a mirror in an optical telescope. They're reflected to the secondary, and there's a reflector at the secondary, and then kind of in a Cassegrain system, they come down to the instruments that are in the middle of the dish. Over here on the right, you see the secondary. This is of the very long baseline array antenna in Pytown, Arizona. They're very similar to the VLA antennas. In fact, they're the same dimension. The receiver is a little bit different, but that's irrelevant. So here we are, and you get an idea of how big these 25 meter dishes are. This is that central Cassegrain aperture where the photons, the radio photons, are coming from above, reflected off of the secondary. And there's a number of windows here for different receivers that are at different frequencies. And then that goes inside of the structure on the back of the dish that I have in the square box over here where the electronics are housed. The photons are converted into electronic signals and then shunted off to the control room. Okay, so there are two ways fundamentally of dealing with radio emission. We can use a single dish, just like a single optical telescope. And this is the Green Bank telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia. And, you know, it's like a big optical telescope, like a big optical mirror. It's a light bucket. It collects a lot of radio photons. It's very sensitive to very faint radio sources, astronomical radio sources, because of that big collecting area. So again, you know, think of this as your big, large optical mirror. So that's the single dish. But we can also have an array, such as the very large array here in central New Mexico, the VLA, and with 27 antennas. They're spaced out in a Y configuration. This is the compact configuration, but they can be spaced out to longer configurations. And why do we do this? We do this because when they operate together, and I'll get into that in a moment here, they act as a single radio telescope with a dish that's the diameter of the widest spacing of the spacing of the widest two elements. And so you get a very large radio telescope, which gives you very high resolution on the sky. Now there's a trade-off though, because you don't have a giant single dish that's that big, right? So you're losing a lot of photons. You're collecting photons, but you're losing a lot because obviously there's a lot of space between these antennas. And if you were to make a circle here that represents the separation of the largest antenna pair, you know, that's like a big dish, but there's lots of empty space. So you get exquisite resolution because the spacing is large, but you lack sensitivity because you lose the majority of the photons that fall within this simulated aperture. So it's a trade-off, right? So these multiple elements must work together. And what I mean is, we need to keep track of the photons as they arrive at each individual radio telescope, each individual antenna. And the way we do that is by injecting a time signal into the data stream from each antenna. And that time signal is basically a chirp at the nanosecond level. So, you know, once every billionth of a second. That's the time resolution that you need to make this work. Okay, so the photons come in, they get converted into electronic signal, time signal is imparted every nanosecond, and then shunted off through a fiber optic system. Those signals from each antenna goes to a massive computer, a supercomputer, that we call the correlator. The correlator then takes every antenna and compares it to every antenna in the array. And what it does is it's taking that data stream and lining up, in essence, it's lining up all those time signals so that the end result now is data from all 27 antennas that are synchronized in time. It does a little bit more than that, but that's basically what's going on. So then now you have simulated a radio dish, a radio telescope dish that has the dimension of the widest separation of the antennas. And here I give you the equation of resolution. It's a simple equation. Resolution is a function of wavelength and the baseline between the widest elements of the array. And as you see, the baseline is in the denominator. So as that baseline increases, the resolution goes down. Okay, so I bring this up because we're going to be talking about an array tonight with Alma. I like to note that radio astronomy is more electrical engineering than astronomy, right? Those photons being converted into electronic signals, there's a lot of technology that goes into that. And importantly, in the radio range of the electromagnetic spectrum is huge. Many, many orders of magnitude larger than the visible light photons that our eyes detect. And the physics underlying the different segments of the radio spectrum are significantly different, such that the technology used to detect them and to convert them into electronic signals varies across the radio frequency. Even in the wave band of ALMA that we'll see is about three orders of magnitude in frequency, there are at least 10 different technologies required to be able to pick up the photons and then convert them into electronic signal. So it's very, very complex, much more complex than, you know, our simple CCD cameras that we use in the visible part of the spectrum. And so here we have a representation of the electromagnetic spectrum, and you see how, you know, small the visible light portion is and how large the radio is. If we look down on the bottom with everything flipped, I apologize for that. But you know, the visible light spectrum is in a factor of a couple in frequency. The radio spectrum is, as you can see, is many, many orders of magnitude. And if we poke down in the microwave area where ALMA is operating, we're about three orders of magnitude in frequency range. So it's just an enormous range of frequencies. And again, along that range, the technology required to pick up the photons varies significantly. So it's very complicated. Okay, so now let's focus on, no pun intended, on the ALMA Observatory. ALMA stands for the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. And as John pointed out, water vapor is important in the radio portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, and in particular in the millimeter submillimeter portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. So here ALMA is in its high altitude plateau, the Chagnantor Plateau in northern Chile. And here I show you the northern half, more or less, of Chile with Santiago on towards the bottom. And ALMA up here in the upper right, the Chagnantor Plateau, is right on the border with Bolivia. Bolivia comes down, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but comes down and just skims. The observatory is about a kilometer and a half from Bolivia. Nearest airport is Calama, a mining town. And Calama is about 2.5 hours flight from Santiago. So that gives you the scale here. Calama is, so one flies into Calama and then drives out to San Pedro, which is the nearest small village. This could be considered. That's about an hour and a half drive. And we're at the kind of the boundary of the Atacama Desert here. And ALMA itself is well within the Atacama Desert. Again, a very dry environment, one of the driest environments, although not as dry, at least in large portions of it, as we were led to believe watching, you know, documentaries from 50 years ago that said, you know, nowhere in the Atacama has it rained in the last 150 years. Well, that's incorrect. In fact, I was there 3 weeks ago and we had torrential rains, including up at the high site where it gets lots of snow as well. And so from San Pedro, it's about 40 minutes to the ALMA Observatory. So, you know, you can see civilization from the observatory, but it's not much of civilization. And so let me go back here. So ALMA is the observatory itself, the antennas are up just under 17,000 feet altitude, 5,100 meters. And again, the reason for this is because at that altitude, you don't have much water vapor above you. In fact, ALMA typically operates with a water column above the antennas out to space of much less than a millimeter, sometimes as low as a tenth of a millimeter water vapor. Again, you know, from the dish of the antenna all the way out to space, if you collapsed the water column, you'd get one tenth of a millimeter of water. And so not much. It's important, again, because water vapor is absorbing quite readily the millimeter submillimeter photons. Okay, so some quick facts. I'll talk through these, lots of words here, but lots of interesting facts, right? So ALMA is made up of 66 antennas. There are 54 12 meter antennas and 12 7 meter antennas, and they can be spaced in different configurations, ranging from the compact configuration of 150 meters separation between the most widely spaced antennas all the way out to 16 kilometers. Again, the separation between the most widely spaced antennas. And so thereby simulating a single radio dish of between 150 meters and 16 kilometers in diameter. They operate in the millimeter range, as you see there, in submillimeter 0.3 to 6 millimeters. Radio astronomers like to talk about frequency, so 950 to 35 gigahertz. And they use 10 receivers to probe that range of frequency. Again, high and dry, 16,570 feet. That's the highest I measured on my iPhone. The formal altitude is a little bit less than that, but in fact, it's a little bit higher than that. And it's in this location called the Chaguntor Plateau. One of the surrounding volcanoes is called Chaguntor. When it was being built, it was the highest construction project on Earth. It's the highest altitude observatory. It's the most complex scientific instrument. And the reason is the correlator, the computer that's making all of this possible, is a supercomputer. In fact, it's the world's fastest supercomputer. It's one or two orders of magnitude faster than the supercomputers that you hear about, you know, that are doing these fantastic things that we hear about in the news. But I hasten to add, it's a stupid supercomputer. Because unlike those supercomputers that we hear about that are vying to be the fastest on Earth, they're not, as we just now learned. Those supercomputers are doing a lot of, you know, high quality mathematics and algorithms and that sort of thing. The supercomputer at ALMA is merely multiplying and dividing two numbers against each other. It's just doing that very, very rapidly. And so I say it's a stupid supercomputer because it's not running code. I mean, it is running code, but again, all it's doing is multiplying numbers. Sometimes it divides numbers. As an astronomical facility, but actually as a scientific facility, it receives the most proposals of any scientific instrument, 1,860 at the last cycle. This is more than James Webb Space Telescope, and I'm kind of surprised. We've gone through two cycles now at Webb, and I'm sure the Webb proposals will pick up, but they haven't yet surpassed ALMA. So that's really quite impressive. It's an international project. So the National Science Foundation is responsible for the North American portion with our Canadian colleagues. Europe, the European Southern Observatory is involved, and East Asia. So Taiwan and Japan. North America and Europe both have a 37.5% share, and East Asia has a 25.5% share. There are three main components, physical components of the observatory, the so-called observatory support facility, where housing of staff and operations, maintenance and that sort of thing take place. And that's at about 10,000 feet. Humans, at least in the Western world, given our safety laws and requirements, humans can't stay overnight for extended periods above 10,000 feet. That's not allowed. And so the observatory support facility is where the dormitories are and where most of the staff are working during the day. The array operations site, the AOS, is what I showed you in that first image. It's where the antennas and the correlator building are located, again, at just under 17,000 feet. People work there, but they can only work there on 8-hour shifts during the day. And then down in Santiago is where the observatory director's office is, along with administrative and some scientific staff. An operations room has been built down in Santiago, and eventually, probably next year, we'll be doing all operations down in Santiago. It's cheaper than having people go up to the OSF to run the observatory, because in Chile, a lot of the workforce is in shifts and they commute. So most of the workforce that go up to the OSF commute from the Santiago area every 10 days. And so they go up for a 10-day shift and then they're off for a week or so, and then they go back up. This is very common in Chile. All the mines, most of the mines in Chile, which is basically what's happening in the north, are located in the north. And most of the miners go in these sorts of shifts as well and commute from elsewhere. There's not much going on, that far north. It's naturally very beautiful, but it really is isolated. Okay, and then I was down there 3 weeks ago because this year is the 10th anniversary of the ending of construction of ALMA. So we had a big blowout kickoff event on the 11th of March. We're in one of the maintenance hangars here, getting ready for the event, and it was great. It was great that, number one, it's been 10 years, kind of unbelievable, and it was a great celebration. And throughout the year, there's going to be various things. So keep your eye open for press releases and whatnot throughout the year. Okay, as one enters the ALMA compound, as it were, we come across the kind of the dry lake bed that is in this area. Other areas, there's salt flats and whatnot. And then if you can see my cursor, which I think you can, there's kind of a little white line up here. This is the operations support facility that's about 25 minutes away. So I guess it's 5 or 6 miles from here. And then you see these high mountains. These are volcanoes. Most of them are not active. One of them, every once in a while, puffs off some steam and smoke. Not in this image, not at this time. But they are about 20, 21,000 feet in altitude. And behind them is the Chagdantor Plateau, where the antennas are. This dark brown stuff is historic lava flows from these volcanoes. I don't know exactly how old they are. Might be kind of on the million year time frame. So here we are at the Observatory Support Facility, the OSF. And here's that hangar that I showed you, the corner of the kickoff meeting. We have up in the middle, at the top in the middle, we have where the operations room is, where the laboratories are. The cryogenic labs are the most advanced cryogenic facilities in the Southern Hemisphere. And then, not in this picture because this is a little bit older, but over here on the bottom left is where, at this point, when this picture was taken, the dormitory, cafeteria, and other kind of housing facility will be built. And I'll show you a picture of that. Another view, close-up view of the operations building here, right behind these antennas that are here for maintenance. Actually, this image was made when the antennas were being assembled and then shipped up to the high site. So labs and offices, scientific support staff, technical support staff, they're all housed in these buildings. Power generation is off to the left. ALMA provides its own power. There's no grid power up at this area. And so they have liquefied natural gas turbines. About 5 megawatts is what's required of this facility. This is the operations room. Not much to see. A bunch of computer terminals, but this is the heart of the control of Alma. Again, a mirror image of this has been created in the San Diego offices, and this will probably eventually be moved out. In fact, in the next 4 or 5 years, we've just started constructing a new correlator, the next generation correlator that's going to be in this building. These are the dormitories, the residencia. Looking at the dormitories themselves, there are 120 rooms, 120 people can be housed. And then off to the right is the main building where the cafeteria and some offices are housed. And here's a view on the second floor of the cafeteria. This is the residencia. It is a product of the Europeans, and the Europeans like luxury, as it were. Not that this is necessarily luxurious, but they like the look of that. And if you've been to any of their optical facilities that are down in Chile, they have the same architects and they look very similar, one from the other. But it's very nice, it's comfortable. And again, you know, people come up here for these long shifts and there's not much else to do. So providing for their health and well-being is really quite an important thing that we do and spend a lot of time trying to get right. Other sorts of residents there, these are the wild burros that were probably brought the conquistadors in the 16th century, but they're roaming at this altitude, freely, and they come by. They're really quite ornery. They don't like the people much, but they come up right to the buildings. And then this is at 15,000 feet. We see the vicuña. Notice the vegetation, right? So this is the Atacama where you're supposed to get 1 millimeter of rain every 150 years. Well, it seems that there's a rain band at between about 14,000 and about 15,500 feet. And so it's really quite lush, you know, for a desert at this altitude. And it's no wonder that we're finding the indigenous animals here. These are vicuña, are a relative, as you might imagine, of the llama and the alpaca. They're smaller than an alpaca. They're about half size of an alpaca. And if you stop your cars, as we did here, they tend to climb over the top and cross the road that way rather than going around the cars. For some reason, they like to climb over them. But again, it's nice to see, some living things out there, because there's not much else. So now we're going up. We left our vicuña at 15,000 feet and we're going up. And here this is just to show you that this is my iPhone screenshot. We're at 16,570 feet, just outside the correlator building. And at that altitude, oxygen is required. And so we go up with oxygen canisters and have them turned on at full bore all the time. It's really quite amazing, because even with oxygen, you feel the effects of the altitude, or rather the lack of oxygen, and each person experiences it differently. For me, for about 10 minutes, I feel like I'm walking through molasses. I can hardly lift my legs, and it feels like I'm moving in slow motion, and then all of a sudden it clears up and you're back to normal. I should note that medical exam is required, blood pressure primarily, before you're able to go up. I'm only able to go up about 50% of the time. I fail the medical test about 50% of the time. So every worker who goes up is tested before they go up. And then medical support staff throughout the day, as they're working their shifts, they check their blood oxygen level. Here we see some of the antennas. If you notice in the middle, slightly to the left of center, there's a grouping, a very large grouping of smaller antennas. These are the 7 meter antennas, and they form a dense core that is attempting to collect those photons that we would otherwise miss. Excuse me. I want to point out the white areas that you see on the ground are the pads, excuse me, that the antennas sit on. And so the antennas can be moved around for different configurations, as I've noted the spacing. And these are the pads they sit on. The pads have power and data links. And then in the distance, the curved building here is the correlator, the correlator building where the correlator computer is. And here's a close up of it. The new correlator will not be at the high site. When ALMA was built, the data runs, the fiber optic runs needed to be limited, and it was very difficult to bring it down to the OSF. That's all changed now, and it's much easier to work at that lower altitude, of course, so that the new computer will be down at the lower altitude. Again, this is going to be 5 or 6 years in the future. These are the large antennas, and there are four of them. Well, sorry, there are four antenna. There are two antenna types, the 7 meter and the 12 meter, and you see all of them here. The 12 meters, there are three types because there are three regional partners in the ALMA consortium, right? So every regional partner wants to have jobs for their heavy industries. And so ALMA, that was the ALMA agreement that the partners would each build a subset of the antennas, you know, with their industry. Japan's antennas were built by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, for example. And they're all slightly different. So the specs, the specifications from the scientific perspective and engineering perspective are identical, but the way they were put together is slightly different. And so we'll have a test at the end, but the North American antennas have these curved secondary supports, just like the East Asian ones. But the difference between North America and East Asia is that the secondary support for East Asia ends before the edge of the antenna, of the dish, whereas North American antenna secondary supports go to the end. And then the European ones have the triangular secondary supports. And they're a little bit cleaner in lines. You don't see the back of them, but they're nice and clean. Someone, an engineer, told me that the European antennas are sexy compared to the other ones. And that's just the European way of doing things. Here's a panoramic view of, I'm there with my colleagues on a visit, just to kind of show you what the environment looks like there with the volcanoes in the distance. That deep blue color of the sky is natural. That's not a camera effect. And we're up there again because of the low atmospheric water vapor. And so here's the transmission bands on the left, bottom left, showing frequency and transmission. Transmission of one is, you know, unimpeded transmission of a photon, and zero is, of course, is completely absorbed. And you see that even in the dry Atacama desert, where we have, you know, such little water vapor, you still get absorption. And so the horizontal bars along the top, numbered 1-10, are the receivers that ALMA uses to observe these frequency ranges. And they are situated along the this portion of the electromagnetic spectrum to avoid regions where the water vapor is truly, you know, removing all of the photons, as you can see in band 8 and 9 and 9 and 10. On the upper right, if you're interested, it gives you the specific frequency range. I won't leave that up much longer. So the receivers in ALMA, there are 10 of them, and only just recently 10. The final two receivers have only just now started to be constructed, and they're being emplaced in the antennas. But these receiver cartridges are about a yard tall. And so the light from the photons from the astronomical source is coming from above, you know, going off of that secondary, going through the windows in the base of the dish. And then they come through to the receivers, and they come to the top, and then they get converted into electronic signal. And it comes out the bottom as an electronic signal through fiber optics. The entire canister is cooled to cryogenic temperatures. The top portion is cooled with liquid helium to between 2 and 4 degrees Kelvin. And then the lower canister is at 70 degrees Kelvin. There's a bunch of receivers all set to go. And then they come into this big canister that's about 4.5 feet in diameter. You see that in this case, two of the receivers are not here. They are now starting to fill in these two receivers, bands 1 and 2. But these are all the different receivers. And you can see visually that they're each one is unique because they are dealing with the photons in a significantly different way for each one of them, depending on what the frequency band is. Some of them have a little second, tertiary and quaternary mirrors here that you can see. Some have radio wave guides. Here's a wave guide. Here's a wave guide that's slightly different. Others are just, you know, a big piece of aluminum. And so each frequency region is slightly different. But all of those photons get converted into electronic signal, and then that portion of the canister is the same. These little copper coils that you see here are all heat sinks. They're all removing heat from the electronics. And all of this is cooled to, like I say, 2 to 4 degrees Kelvin. Why? Because most of the sources, the astronomical sources that Alma was observing, is at that temperature. And so, you know, if you had a hot receiver above 4 degrees Kelvin, the noise wouldn't allow you to pick up the signal. As it is, we're picking up signal below the noise level. Here's an image of the correlator in the correlator building. This is 20-year-old technology. So our new correlator is going to be significantly better. It's just a big bank of lots of computer chips doing multiplications, many, many of them per second. We move those antennas with the so-called transporters. Transporter, there are two of them that are purpose-built by a German firm who provided them for free because it was a small business, and Mr. Scheuerle, as you see here, wanted his name on something that was associated with Alma. There are 28 bogies here with 28 wheels on these 14 bogies that each can move independently. And there are two 1600 horsepower diesel engines. One of them provides power to the antenna at all times. So the transporter attaches to the antenna, power and power is linked to one of these diesel engines because the antenna needs to be powered up continuously. They are never powered down. You might ask me about that later on. Then they bring the antenna up that incline and move it wherever they need to move it. And then they put it back onto another pad. The transporter can place the antenna within a fraction of a centimeter on whatever pad it's going to. Again, all the time it's throughout that process it's being powered. So one of those 1600 horsepower engines is powering the antenna, the other is driving the transporter. When they get to 17,000 feet, the engines are derated by 60% because of the altitude. So they're no longer 1600 horsepower, they're 60% less. And there you see an antenna being picked up by the transporter. I need to watch my time. I'm not mindful of my time. I have a little video here, 20 seconds, that I want to show you of the transporters moving and picking up antennas. I note that they are sped up, right? They only move at about a half a mile to a mile an hour. They're very slow. It takes 8 hours to move an antenna from the OSF to the high site and put it on a pad. The way you can tell they're sped up is they're moving fast, but if you never saw them in person, you wouldn't know that, but their flashing lights are moving faster than you would expect a flashing light to move. So keep that in mind as you're watching.
Colossal. Heavy. Ultra precise. Extremely maneuverable.
They can be driven in a cab or with remote control. You saw that.
Whenever an ALMA transporter moves a fragile, high-tech antenna, there is a lot at stake.
They weigh 110 tons.
This is demanding work for both man and machine. Give you an idea of what's going on here. The two huge ALMA transporters, named Otto and Lore, crawl across the magnificent landscape of the Chilean Atacama Desert, moving the sensitive antennas with the precision of the finest Swiss clockwork. The capacity to relocate the antennas is a crucial aspect of the operation of the powerful ALMA array.
Okay. It is a crucial aspect of the ALMA array because, again, you know, we have those different configurations giving us the different baselines. Okay, just a pretty picture of the wonderful Milky Way. I'm sure some of you have been to the Southern Hemisphere. If you haven't, it's worth going to. And I'll tell you that one of the most, especially when you're in a location like this, one of the most amazing things is you get the true feeling of three-dimensionality when you're looking out across the Milky Way. It's really quite disconcerting. Really quite amazing with the dust clouds of the central Milky Way, and it's remarkable. I'm going to show this a little bit. There's no sound because it shows the antennas moving, and they can move very rapidly. In fact, this is real time fast track, and they move that rapidly with absolutely no sound. The motors that drive the antennas make no sound whatsoever. And in fact, it's quite, you see that they're fenced off because it's dangerous to be around them because you can't hear them moving. This is not sped up. This is real time. Again, high speed station keeping movement. I should note that these are the highest precision millimeter wave antennas ever created. Okay, we can do that. Okay, so let me spend the remaining time looking at some science. I promised to give you some game-changing science results from ALMA. And almost everything that ALMA is doing is game-changing. And the reason is because the millimeter wavelength region of the electromagnetic spectrum has been under-observed. There are other millimeter wave radio telescopes all over the world. The biggest one is in Mexico, in fact, southeast of Mexico City, about halfway between Mexico City and Veracruz, the large millimeter telescope. And it's been around for quite some time. And you know, there are other millimeter wave telescopes here and there. But that region of the electromagnetic spectrum is very difficult to observe in, again, for the environmental reasons. And so we haven't really studied it very well until ALMA came on. And then ALMA just has these fantastic capabilities with its very high resolution. So almost everything coming out of ALMA is, you know, spectacular and new. So what I did in putting this together at the last minute, I had a different talk designed for you a couple of months ago. When I came back from the 10th anniversary, I got to thinking about kind of the key findings that ALMA has made over the last 10 years. And there are three or four main areas. So I want to talk to you about those tonight, rather than giving you kind of a whole survey of what I had anticipated doing before. Although I have those slides, we can talk about that if there are questions. So I think that the main areas that ALMA has really contributed to are our understanding of protoplanetary disks. And so these are the debris disks in stars that have newly formed. And this is the stuff that remains after the star has formed and is now forming planets. And then the spectroscopic capabilities of ALMA and the sorts of things that it observes are complex molecules in star-forming regions in particular. And then black holes and other things that are not as expected from the early universe. So let's start with the protoplanetary disks. These are images of protoplanetary disks before ALMA. And, you know, we can see that there's a disk there, right? So in the middle of these images is a newly formed star of varying ages, several million to several hundreds of millions of years old, on the lower end of hundreds of millions, 1 to 200 million years old. And, you know, there's a disk around them. So that's fantastic. I point and notice the scale here. So I point to HL tau in the upper left. And you see the scale bar is 100 astronomical units, 100 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So our solar system would be in the very central part where that little black cross is, right? This is big, big structure. Okay, so HL tau before ALMA, and on the left is HL tau with ALMA. And we just see exquisite detail in these protoplanetary disks. Over on the right, TW Hydrae is another example of a almost face-on protoplanetary disk with substructure and gaps and knots and things in the rings. And so what we're seeing here is, well, there are two schools of thought, although the field is rapidly coming down to one of them. The two likely interpretations of the gaps, the dark regions in these protoplanetary disks. Number one is that they're caused by a deposition of ices, snow, that's depositing out and being interacted with by the photons coming off of the newly formed star. It's causing the snow, the ices to clump up. And so this is a scenario where we don't need planets, right? Because there's a non-planetary explanation for this. The other explanation is that the dark gaps are caused by planets. In the HL tau case, these would be multiple Jupiter-sized planets, up to 10 times the mass of Jupiter. And as they're orbiting, they're clearing out the disk that's in their orbit. So until about, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, those two scenarios kind of had equal billing. We're now rapidly approaching a point where it's likely that these are in fact caused by planets. Not only because in some cases, we're seeing the planets, we don't see the planets in either of these two images. In some cases we do, but also it's a better explanation for some of the substructure, in particular the knotty substructure that we see, because as the planets orbit, especially if you have two planets, they're doing the shepherding of particles like in the rings of Saturn, where we see twists and braids and knottiness in clumpiness, I should say, in the regions where the planets aren't located. But everywhere we look around newly formed stars, we find protoplanetary disks like this. This is a subset of a survey of newly formed stars, and you see the disks in all sorts of structures. You have disks that have hot spots, and you have spiral structures in some of the disks. One here on the left, one here in the bottom. You have disks that have huge gaps. You have binary stars, like on the bottom right here, where one of the stars has a very small protoplanetary disk, probably because it's been eroded by its companion star. My personal favorite is this one in the far upper left, where you have a binary star system and the disks are tilted to each other, right? So the stars, I don't know if these particular stars I don't know this particular object, and it's not my field, but, you know, presumably the stars are orbiting in a plane, but their disks are not in that plane for whatever reason. Have they been torqued? Did they form in the same plane and they've been torqued? Did they form like this? You know, I don't think we know the answer to that, but it's just remarkable, right? And it's not surprising, and it shouldn't be surprising, because we find planets, older planets around older stars everywhere we look, right? So you're going to be finding protoplanetary disks. So these protoplanetary disks are the stage where the planets are just now starting to form, right? If you have a 100-million-year-old star, that's kind of what's happened in our solar system, where, you know, about 100 million years after the sun formed, you're starting to coalesce and form the planets. And the planets now are forming, and they're sweeping up as they orbit. They're sweeping up the material that's in their orbit. Eventually, they'll be fully formed, and eventually, the debris that we're seeing here with ALMA will be blown out of the solar system, that stellar system, and, you know, we'll have the individual planets without the surrounding protoplanetary disk. With ALMA and that exquisite resolution, we see not only the protoplanetary disk. This is one on the left, where you have the star in the middle, almost not detecting that star very well because it's too hot. But you have a planet here. So PDS 70b, that's a planet, and it's in a gap, right? So this is, again, what I said earlier, that we're starting to see planets in the gap. There's another planet over here on the right, PDS 70c, where the arrow on the right is pointing. And what I note here is that not only is there a planet there, but the planet has a circumplanetary disk. This is a disk, presumably, out of which satellites around that planet are forming. Okay, this is the first example of that. There are a couple more now. But again, it's just remarkable that not only are we seeing the disks from which planets are forming, but we're seeing the disks around the planets from which their moons are forming as well. We see stellar interactions of multiple star systems with these protoplanetary disks. And this is a multi-wavelength observation, the main image, and on the right you can see the components. So the Subaru optical telescope on Mauna Kea, the very long, large array, the VLA in New Mexico, radio observation, and then ALMA, both continuum and carbon monoxide, showing you the disk that is being disrupted. We see tidal disruption here, and it's being disrupted because one of its companion stars, but perhaps not a binary star, it's probably a star that's formed in a cluster, and one of the cluster members is making a close approach and pulling off material from the protoplanetary disk. This object is in fact a binary star that you see in this depiction on the right, and then this third member is zipping by and gravitationally disrupting the protoplanetary disk. So again, just remarkable work that ALMA is producing here. Advance, there we go. Okay, so the spectroscopy that ALMA affords is remarkable as well. And here's an example I show from the band 10 receiver. The ALMA spectrum, this is a spectrum of a star forming region, the Catspaw Nebula in our galaxy. And you see the spectrum along the top in blue from ALMA. And just to give you an example, in this frequency range, the previously best instrument providing a spectrum was the Herschel Space Telescope, European Space Telescope. And its spectrum is shown inverted, just to be able to put it here. And Herschel had a fantastic spectroscope, but you can see it's nothing like ALMA. These peaks are all emission lines from complex molecules. A couple of them are noted here. This is methane ethanol, ethane, and carbon monoxide. So there are some known molecules here, but the vast majority of these emission lines are from unknown molecules. And so the laboratory astrophysicist is going to be spending a long time with spectra like this, figuring out what's going on. But these are all complex molecules, hydrocarbons, amino acids, that sort of thing in these star-forming regions. A recent discovery by ALMA is of this large molecule, 9-atom molecule called dimethyl ether. And it was found in a protoplanetary disk that you see there. It's the largest molecule identified to date from an astronomical source. And what's getting the laboratory astrophysicists and the astrobiologists really spun up about this is that this is a precursor of larger organic molecules. And again, this is material that's going and forming planets around this particular star. And so we're seeing these organic molecules and precursor to biologically important molecules. We are finding them in the material that's forming the planets and eventually will rain down on the planets after they, after they solidify. Now's my time. So almost at the end here. So black holes, of course, and we talked about this last time, but I need to show the black hole image of M87 because number one, it's the first and it's fantastic. ALMA played a key role in this observation. And I think I showed this at my last talk. And this is well known. The image of the full array, by the way, at the highest resolution that humans have ever taken. This is the equivalent of looking at a tennis ball on the moon, 50 microarc seconds. If we didn't have ALMA, this is what the image would look like. I learned when I was down in Chile 3 weeks ago, that in fact, what they did to make this image was merely remove the ALMA component. So, but the image was calibrated with the ALMA data. So in fact, if we looked at the raw data without ALMA, this would just be a blob, with no structure whatsoever. So it's actually even worse without ALMA. So ALMA, it was a key component and will be in the future for the Event Horizon Telescope observations. And then of course we have our nice image of our black hole in Sagittarius A star in the Milky Way, the center of the Milky Way. But what I wanted to point out that ALMA has been discovering, along with other telescopes and now the James Webb Space Telescope, is large, very large black holes very early in the universe. This is an example of this is an artist rendition, of course, but this is an example of one of these objects, an 800 million solar mass black hole, 13.04 billion light years away. So at a point when the universe was 690 million years old. There are others. There are at least two others. There's a quasar with a 1.2 billion solar mass black hole, and there's another billion solar mass black hole that's from the same period. It's from a little bit earlier. The problem is we can't figure out how supermassive black holes with this mass have formed in this short amount of time. So the ways we think supermassive black holes form, and I have to add that we don't understand that very well, but the ways we think that are logical for them to form, there isn't enough time for an 800 million solar mass black hole to have formed 690 million years after the Big Bang. So this is a interesting mystery. Now, so ALMA is detecting these things in the very early universe. It's also, as is Webb and a couple of our other optical telescopes, the big ones now that we're starting to look very early in the universe, we're finding very large galaxies very early in the universe in a way that they shouldn't be. in the same way, that they're so large, how did they get there? There wasn't enough time for them to form in ways that we think they form. This is a Milky Way lookalike galaxy, but it's forming stars at a prodigious rate, about 240 stars per year. The Milky Way forms kind of less than one star per year. So lots of star formation activity. And what we see, because ALMA can do this, we see the Doppler shift of the gas as it's rotating around the galaxy. We see a blue shift as it's coming towards us and a red shift as it's going away. So this is a rotating disk, almost exactly like the Milky Way. It's about the same mass as the Milky Way at a red shift at 12 billion light years. This interesting observation was made with a gravitational lens. In fact, the lens was almost perfectly aligned. We had an almost perfect Einstein ring. And when we're able to decompose that, we get the galaxy image in the middle. So ALMA is looking at very cold material, like the protoplanetary disks, and it's looking at very high redshift objects because their emission is being shifted into the millimeter range. So we're seeing these galaxies forming at time in sizes and at times where they shouldn't be. They're too early. Not only that, but we're seeing very early galaxies that have been enriched with heavy elements that are produced in stars, right? Like in this case, oxygen. These elements are produced in stars through nucleosynthesis, just like they are today. But these objects are at redshifts of 12 and 13. So we're talking between 300 and 375 million years after the Big Bang. And they have already been enriched with heavy elements, in this case, again, oxygen, in ways that our models are indicating is not possible. And so this is, you know, this is what happens in astronomy. We look out with a new telescope, with new technology and a new frequency range region, new wavelength region, and we discover old friends and new things that we haven't expected. And I think, you know, we're going to be hearing a lot about this. Webb, a couple of weeks ago, Webb came out with, you know, detecting 9 galaxies at this redshift. Those galaxies that Webb observed, by the way, their redshifts were confirmed by ALMA. So ALMA and Webb are working very nicely complementarily. You know, ALMA, of course, in the millimeter and Webb in the infrared, they're very close together. So they're going to be observing very similar objects, and we're going to be answering some of these questions. But a lot of strange things are happening in the early universe. Large galaxies, large supermassive black holes that are too early for the models and the, you know, that our simulations are showing. These large galaxies are being enriched with heavy elements in ways that we didn't think there was enough star formation to take place in that short amount of time. But there is. And so we're going to have to explain that. Okay, so let me end there. And again, just give you a little foretaste of, you know, of what ALMA can do, but it's fantastic. And so let's take questions. So Elizabeth, I see Elizabeth's hand up. Oh, that's as you're clapping. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Clapping, yeah. Have a question, actually. Can you go back just a few slides to the Einstein ring?
I'm opening up my chat. I don't know if there's anything.
Well, I do have a question, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Can you go back to the slide with the Einstein ring?
Yes. Yep.
So what you're saying is that they were seeing that Einstein ring and they deconvolved that to get that middle image?
Yes, and using the Doppler information.
Holy moly.
So this is interesting aspect of radio astronomy in general at some vague-ish level, but more importantly for ALMA, is that you can get the three-dimensional component as well at the source, right? I mean, you're getting three-dimensional from redshift too, but But ALMA can pick up the Doppler, and it does that in a number of things. We've seen jets coming out of protoplanetary disks, and you can track it with a Doppler, and so that's really kind of neat, and that's one thing that's allowed this deconstruction to occur.
But that's what I'm saying, is that all of that information is sort of embedded into that ring.
Yep.
And all they're seeing is technically the ring, and it's just doing the software deconvolution.
Yes.
That is impressive.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. And I didn't point it out, but it's written there. So the object is at a redshift of 4.2, and the lens is at 0.26, which is typically what we see in these rings. But that is, so the observation itself, right? The gravitational lens is useful, as they always are, right? They're magnifying distant objects. I don't know with 100% certainty, but this galaxy probably would not have been detected without the gravitational lens. So, you know, that's neat on its own. It's neat that it's an Einstein ring. We don't get very many of those. But then, in addition, we have this funky galaxy, right? It could have just been any galaxy that was lensed, but we have this very distant galaxy that's completely unexpected because of its size. Now, it's not quite as early as, you know, some of those other ones, but still, it's a big galaxy that's forming a lot of stars in a way that's really not quite the way we think they should be.
Okay, so there were a couple questions in the chat. Mm-hmm. Jeff was asking about if those were solar arrays on some of the building roofs, I guess, early on.
They are not. What they look like solar arrays, but what they're solar protection fundamentally. You know, it's at 10,000 feet and it's very dry. And so the UV index is very, very high. So that's a little bit of protection. We are looking at, we're experimenting with solar panels. We will be soon. And they're going to put solar panels down at the OSF, kind of a 500 kilowatt experiment, and see what's going on. There's problems with the solar panels at the high site. We'd like to put them at the high site, but the altitude affects the solar panel efficiency. And so you lose a lot of efficiency at altitude. Mm-hmm. You lose a lot of efficiency at 10,000 feet too, but it's not as bad.
Hmm. Huh. Okay, I think Sue has a question.
Yes, Sue.
First of all, I just wanted to thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
The mind-blowing technology and the great photography as well.
Well, thank you. That most of the photography was not me. I think John.
Well, you curated it.
yes. There's a lot. So I should point out, I should put that at the end. Fantastic ALMA website is almaobservatory.org. And they have, you know, there's galleries and press releases and that sort of thing. And you can also, you know, go to nrao.edu on their press release page, and lots of ALMA press releases there. But obviously the ALMA Observatory has lots of technical detail. There's lots of stuff for schools and education and all sorts of neat things if you're interested.
And a bit of a quibble. I believe there is one observatory at a higher altitude, and that's a cosmic ray observatory in Bolivia, which I was told was staffed entirely by Bolivians. Although I suppose if a visiting astronomer from Tibet wanted to work there, that would probably be okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the correction. I'm from Denver, and the University of Denver has an observatory at Mount Evans, which you can see from Denver, and you know that was at 14.4, and I think that's the highest optical observatory, but I don't think it's operating anymore. Anyway.
So along those lines, there was a question from Steve. He was asking, how do the scientists and support staff deal with the loss of communication and thinking skills with oxygen deprivation at high altitudes?
Yes, thank you. So that's a great question. They're all wearing oxygen, and they're, like I said, their blood oxygen levels are tested frequently. The medics run around throughout the day, and like every 10 or 15 minutes. There is a hit. You become accustomed to it, however, and especially if you're there on, you know, over multiple days. So those of us who go and visit, going up once, you know, is problematic. But if you're there, the first day is kind of bad, but then in subsequent days, it gets better. They're only there, like I say, in 8-hour shifts. And most of those staff have been doing it regularly. Now, of course, most everybody is down at 10,000 feet, and that's still high altitude, but once you acclimatize to that, that's not that bad. But there's lots of checks. Now, interestingly, apparently, even though humans, you know, work at and live at higher altitudes, not much research had been done before ALMA. And so a number of universities have taken the opportunity to study the workforce at high altitude. And that research is still underway. But what they're finding is there's no one common thing. Each individual has an individual physiological response. Some people are affected when they go up to high altitude. The vast majority have greater effects when they come down from higher altitude. And the thinking is that when you're at high altitude, your body pumps you full of hormones to help you survive. And then when you come down to the lower altitudes, all those hormones have to be, metabolized away. And it's that process that causes all sorts of problems. You know, people do have accidents when they come down very infrequently, but again, almost all of the problems happen when they come back down to 10,000 feet. Interestingly.
Jeff, you had another question. Do you want to ask it?
I actually have a couple more there. First, since we're talking about observatories at high altitude, in your early pictures that showed the site, looked like maybe an aerial, maybe it was an aerial view, possibly from a drone. And way off in the background, over on the right side toward the mountain, there's a building that kind of looks like an observatory.
Was it my opening shot from the?
Yes, or just about the, not that one. You actually showed the shot a couple times.
This one.
Yeah. Way off towards the mountains on the right.
So I think over here, up on the upper right.
Yeah, there.
I think that's Apex. So there are, that seems awfully close. There are three or four other observatories. There's Apex, there's CCT, I can't think of the acronyms. I'm having a senior moment at the moment. They're all radio observatories. And so they're spread out on the plain and towards the mountains. So that is an observatory. I think that's an antenna there. I don't think that's ALMA. I think that's the Apex observatory, radio observatory. And the Tokyo Observatory is building an optical telescope on the side of one, I think up here, if my orientation is right. I think it's up on the side here, and it's up at 19,500 feet or so. I don't know how they're going to do that. I think it'll probably be all remote, but it's under construction right now.
Wow.
So this, the ALMA concession is quite a large, it's a large area. Again, you know, the widest separation is 16 kilometers, and I believe that station is way off to the left. But ALMA is in the middle of a larger, what they call the at the Parque Astronomico. It's the astronomical park. And it, the Chilean government has kind of set this aside for optical and radio observatories. And there are a few other observatories in the, not many on the plateau here. They're more off to the, they're outside of the Alma concession, but I believe this is Apex over here on the right.
Wow. And then my other question was on then your slide that showed the bands.
Yes.
And I was wondering what the colors stood for.
It was just to so that you could see those a little bit better. This one here?
Yes.
It's the colors are arbitrary.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and then your the listing also has colors for a few of the bands.
So I think but they don't correspond.
Right.
The reason band 1 and 2 are called out on the upper right is because when this was made, band 1 and 2 did not yet exist.
Ah.
So band 1 now is being, I think the final canisters, receivers are being completed. They're being built by Taiwan. That's part of their contribution. And but they all are only just now being delivered. And so band 1 is just now being in place, and band 2 is going to be coming in shortly.
Hey, thank you. Mm-hmm. Fascinating talk.
Thank you. Status of Arecibo, Raymond asked. Arecibo is, well, of course, you know, sadly, we don't have the telescope there anymore. It's being turned into a science education facility, as it were. So there, we have a call for proposals for organizations that will take over that function, and that's in process as we speak.
John Hornstein had a question in the chat.
Yeah, a wonderful description in Discoveries of Astronomy mentions that radio emission has been detected from the filaments of material in the cosmic web joining clusters of galaxies. Has ALMA played a role? I don't think so. I know that, but I don't know the details of that discovery yet. But I don't believe ALMA. I don't believe ALMA has participated in that. Could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Okay. Do we have any other questions?
And Jim, thank you very much for your kind words. But yeah, any other questions?
Okay. It looks like we've run out of questions. Thank you very much for an excellent talk. Joe,
you're welcome. Yeah, thank you for your attention and interest. It means a lot. Appreciate it.
That's a superb talk.
Thank you. So keep your eyes open for ALMA. Every couple of weeks, there's a press release that goes out, and again, almaobservatory.org is a great website with lots of wonderful resources, and you can delve more deeply into the things that I only briefly was able to mention tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
A link to the observatory website in the chat. So,
yeah.
So that's going through ESO. Yes, there you go. Okay, and yes, you can also go through the ESO sites too. And then again, nrao.edu is our North American partner who is responsible for ALMA through, you know, doing the day-to-day stuff. And of course, you know, they run the VLA and the VLBA. So lots of resources there too. Thank you again. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Good
night. Good night.
Yeah, I happened to go to Chile for the 1994 eclipse when we were up in the Atacama. And the part that I was at was really something. We drove in this bus, an old school bus, for a couple of hours. And except for inside the arroyos, which take the meltwater from the glaciers down to the Pacific Ocean, in that 2-hour trip, except for in the bottom of the arroyos where some people actually live and farm. I think I counted 3 plants over 2-hour drive. That is amazingly dry place. And, you know, when we got to where we were going in the middle of nowhere, just surrounded by gravel and stuff, you know, in the outside, you're accustomed to hearing insects and birds out there. It's really something. And I've been at 14,000 feet in Denver, not in Denver, but in Colorado. You know, walking is a major exercise at that altitude.